Good morning, everyone. It's certainly a very great pleasure to be back with you again. After the meeting last night in South Houston, I began to wonder just how I got away down here from the shores of Georgian Bay, and I just couldn't remember the circumstance that brought me down the first time, so I talked to Sidney to see if he could somehow or another guide me in my thinking, and I believe we figured out how I got all the way down here way back in 1942. That's 35 years ago. And this leads me to conclude that the brethren, the overseeing brethren down here, must be very, very patient and very indulgent. And I just want to express my thanks for another invitation to be here with you. It's a great joy, it's a great pleasure to be here. Now, I am sure you would readily concede to my brother and to myself that neither one of us would face such a convention as this without due exercise in the presence of God. We know that God's people, in coming together, represent a great need. And if the Lord is able to use us, we would like to have something to contribute to the assembly life and testimony of God's people. In being exercised about the conference, I, of course, began to think of different books and different passages and different subjects. Just what would the Lord have me present at this time? And in coming away, I came by way of New York, and in flying down into the New York area, I picked up a great package of notes that I wrote years ago, filed them away, and I came upon some lovely things, at least they're lovely to me, and I've never used them. And as I went over some of these things, I found they were a great blessing to my own soul. And I eventually came to the conclusion that I ought to present some of these things to others. What's the use of writing them up in notes and filing them all away and leaving them in cold storage? So I took them out and I tried to warm them up a little bit. And I trust that they may be used of the Lord. Most of my thinking in the last 2 to 3 weeks, most of my thinking has been governed by my understanding of the 2 epistles to the Corinthians. Now, they're quite different. They are both written by the same spiritual family, as same spiritual father, to the same spiritual family. And yet, what a difference. 1 Corinthians is written by a broken-hearted father to his family who have dishonored him by their misbehavior. And he is deeply hurt. 2 Corinthians is written by a father who has found pleasure in the fact that his family has made certain adjustments and that they are attempting at least to please him and to follow his instructions. Now, let me give you a couple of the characteristics of 2 Corinthians, because we're going to spend these sessions together in 2 Corinthians. I think maybe it's because of the circumstance under which it was written. 2 Corinthians, as far as I can see, is the most personal of all Paul's writings. You know, if you were to take all his personal references and in 2 Corinthians and fit them together chronologically, you would have a grand autobiographical sketch of St. Paul. I repeat, if we were to take all his personal references in 2 Corinthians and piece them chronologically together, you would just have a very, very intriguing autobiographical sketch. That is one of the features of 2 Corinthians. Someday I'd like to follow that through myself. Another one of the outstanding features of 2 Corinthians is the wonderful figurative language that Paul uses. He uses remarkable figurative language in describing himself and in describing God's beloved people. Now, we're going to look at chapter 1. We're going to look at the heart ministry of the Apostle Paul this morning in order we get a good foundation. But when you turn to chapter 2, the Christian is a member of a triumphal procession. When you turn to chapter 3, the Christian is a letter of commendation written and read of all men. When you turn to the end of chapter 3, the Christian is a man who has a veil on his face, but thank God before he gets to the end of the chapter, the veil's removed. When you get into chapter 4, the Christian is an earthen vessel. When you get into chapter 5, there are several pictures there, but I would suggest that the prominent picture there is the Christian is an ambassador. The whole epistle is just blessedly filled with figures of the Christian. What God has made him, what he ought to be in himself, what he will be if he is controlled and governed by the fear of the Lord. Now let us read the first 11 verses of 2 Corinthians chapter 1. Paul, an apostle of Jesus Christ by the will of God, and Timotheus our brother, unto the church of God which is at Corinth, with all saints which are in all Achaia. Grace be to you and peace from God our Father and from the Lord Jesus Christ. Blessed be God, even the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of mercies and the God of all comfort, who comforteth us in all our tribulation, that we may be able to comfort them which are in any trouble by the comfort wherewith we ourselves are comforted of God. For as the sufferings of Christ abound in you, so our consolation also aboundeth by Christ. And whether we be afflicted, it is for your consolation and salvation, which is effectual in the enduring of the same sufferings which we also suffer. Or whether we be comforted, it is for your consolation and salvation. And our hope of you is steadfast, knowing that as ye are partakers of the sufferings, so shall ye be also of the consolation. For we would not, brethren, have you ignorant of our trouble which came to us in Asia, that we were pressed out of measure, above strength, insomuch that we despaired even of life. But we had the sentence of death in ourselves, that we should not trust in ourselves, but in God which raiseth the dead, who delivered us from so great a death, and doth deliver, in whom we trust that he will yet deliver us. He also helping together by prayer for us, that for the gift bestowed upon us by the means of many persons, thanks may be given by many on your behalf. The Apostle Paul, in writing to the saints of God in Colossae, presents to us what we very frequently speak of as his twofold ministry. In chapter 1 of that epistle to the Colossians, you need not turn to it unless you so wish, he writes, "If ye continue in the faith, grounded and settled, and be not moved away from the hope of the gospel which ye have heard, and which was preached to every creature which is under heaven, whereof I, Paul, am made a minister." The gospel which ye have heard, whereof I, Paul, am made a minister. He claims here to be a minister of the gospel. His ministry, as first mentioned to the Colossians, was a ministry, an evangelical ministry. He was preaching Christ and him crucified. And I think the Corinthians, probably above many, learned to understand just what he meant. Last night we were noticing down in South Houston how he went into Athens. Yes, he witnessed for the Lord. He delivered a remarkable sermon, or at least lecture, in Athens. He spoke as a philosopher among philosophers. Paul, a well-educated, a real academic, was able to confront these men of culture and education, and so he spoke to them on their own level, a philosopher to philosophers. But we notice this. You never read that there was a church of God in Athens. You never read that. Now, I know at the end of chapter 18, it suggests that one or two were saved while he was in Athens, but there never were sufficient to form a local church there. The very next city he visited was Corinth. And what did he specify in Corinth for himself as well as for his hearers? He said, "I am not here in Corinth going to speak with the words of man's wisdom." He was no philosopher in one sense when he reached Corinth. What did he say in Corinth? He said, "I'm going to preach nothing but Christ in him crucified." Now, what do we read? Many of the Corinthians, hearing, believed and were baptized, and this letter was addressed to the church of God which is at Corinth. Christ and him crucified. Paul says, "The gospel whereof I am made a minister." Let me read on in this same epistle to the Colossians. "Who now rejoice in my sufferings for you, and fill up that which is behind of the afflictions of Christ in my flesh for his body's sake, which is the church, whereof I am made a minister." He not only said, you know, the gospel whereof I am made a minister, but he said, "the church whereof I am made a minister." Paul was not only an evangelist, but he was a teacher. Sometimes, you know, we're asked, could one man have more than one gift? I believe so. I think there is plenty in the Word of God to substantiate such a contention. And very definitely, Paul was blessed. God entrusted him with more than one gift. And here he is, a teacher, shall we say, of the doctrine of the Christian church. In fact, all that we know about the church, we find in the writings of Paul. If we want to know something about the church universal, we turn to Ephesians. If we want to know something about the administration of church affairs in the local aspect of the church, well, then we turn to the Corinthian letters. But notice now in 1 Corinthians, What's he talking about? Blessed be God, even the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of mercies and the God of all comfort, who comforteth us in all our tribulation, that we may be able to comfort them that are in trouble by the comfort wherewith we ourselves are comforted of God. This is not the ministry of the gospel. It is really not the ministry of the church either. What is it? It's a ministry of the heart. That's what it is. It is a ministry of comfort to the troubled and the distressed, and in those days, the persecuted of God's people. A warm ministry of the heart. I repeat again, a ministry of comfort. Not of the gospel particularly, not of the church particularly, but certainly a ministry of the heart. Now, beloved saints of God, as I think of the years that are past and gone, I am fully convinced that this is what God's people need today. A ministry of the heart. I think one of the greatest compliments that I've received since I was here with you last came in a little note that was handed to me. I had told the story of a servant of Christ, gone now, gone to his reward, but the little story implies that when he ministered to God's people, he ministered in a very warm way. What he had to say was right from one heart to another heart. He ministered. He taught with his heart as much as with his hand. And somebody slipped a little note into my hand, and I repeat, I think it's one of the greatest compliments that has been paid to me. You too, feet is warm. That's all it said in the note. You too, feet is warm. And that's just exactly what I would like to do. The heart knoweth its own bitterness, and a stranger doth not intermeddle with its joy. Man is born to trouble as the sparks fly upward. Now, I want to look into the passage we have read this morning and link it up with one or two others. I want to try and discover what stimulated this warm-hearted ministry of Paul. How is it that he could appeal to the tried and the sorrowing among the people of God and pour into their broken hearts the balm of Gilead? Well, I think the reasons are really on the surface as we go through this epistle. Now, the closing part of our reading this morning, Paul says in verse 8, "We would not, brethren, have you ignorant of our trouble, which came to us in Asia, that we were pressed out of measure, above strength, insomuch that we despaired of life. We had the sentence of death in ourselves." What's he talking about anyway? Now, in an abstract way, we would say he had troubles. He had troubles of his own. Yes, he did. But could you possibly think of anything specific in his life? Well, you read down chapter 11, you'll find a number of specifics there. I always like to read right on into chapter 12 when I'm reading chapter 11. Well, I read chapter 11 and you get to the point almost of despairing for the little man. Oh, the troubles, the multiplicity of troubles that he mentions. And then he starts into chapter 12 and he says, I was raptured up to heaven. Away from all the trials and the troubles and the difficulties of this life, caught right up to the paradise of God, to the third heaven. How well God balances life. If we do have troubles, praise his name, he gives plenty of compensation. But that's not the answer, I don't think, to what we have in chapter 1. Now, there are those, you know, whenever you are confronted by a passage like this, and of course you go to the commentary, you want to know what comments certain great thinkers have made. If you don't, if you turn to certain commentaries, you'll probably read that he fought with the beasts at Ephesus. And some actually literally think that's what he did. That in the arena in Ephesus, he actually fought with wild beasts. And somehow or another, he was given the strength to overcome the wild beasts. Well, that doesn't appeal to me at all. I don't think that's the explanation. And then there are others who say, well, this is not literal. He didn't literally fight with beasts at Ephesus. But he went through such trials in Ephesus. You remember there was that dreadful uprising against the gospel in Ephesus. And of course, he was in the thick of it. And the brethren had to protect him. But it was provoked by his preaching, and he was right in the center of all that trauma. And so some say, no, not literally. Figuratively, he fought with beasts at Ephesus. Figuratively, during that riot, he was fighting with beasts at Ephesus. I don't know. Doesn't appeal to me either. As I read this, I think of probably a time when he thought he was going to die. When he actually wrote his own sentence of death. And he felt that the end of his career had come. Now, I know 3 years later he felt differently. But I think the Lord had intimated certain things to him 3 years later. That is when he wrote his epistle to the Philippians. At this time, I think Paul really thought that he was going home to glory. And so he says here, I would not have you to be ignorant of our physical troubles in Asia. We were pressed beyond measure until we couldn't stand it anymore. Our strength waned. In fact, we were just depleted of spiritual fortitude and vigor. And we prepared to die. You can think of some of God's people, and they have been there, you know. They've really been there. Well, I think of some who have lain right on the edge and laying there for days, and it just seemed as if they were looking across the river and maybe wondering why the ferry boat didn't come to take him across. Fully prepared to go, ready to go, glad to go. And yet, God has brought them back. So it was with Paul. I believe one of the first things that God used in revealing this particular line of ministry to Paul was a grave illness. You know, it's not a bit difficult to think of his traveling through Asia to Troas, and then across from Troas into Macedonia. And when he wrote this letter, I think he was in his beloved Philippi. He was in Macedonia. I think that is quite conclusive. And probably in Philippi. But that is not the only means that God used to teach him that what God's people needed was a ministry of the heart. Turn back, please, to 1 Corinthians, just for a verse or two there. Now, as we have said, 1 Corinthians was written by a broken-hearted father to his children who so misbehaved that he was deeply affected. In chapter 4 of 1 Corinthians, verse 17, we read, "For this cause have I sent unto you Timotheus, who is my beloved son, and faithful in the Lord." He not only wanted to contact the church by letter, but he actually sent a representative to the church. He sent young Timothy. He was the only man who was like-minded as himself, the only man who was willing to sacrifice everything for the full benefits of God's people. And so Paul said to him one day, "Timothy, I want you to make your way back to Corinth. I've written them, but look, Timothy, go back to Corinth." And so in chapter 4, he is sending Timothy back to Corinth. Look at chapter 16, and it's verse 10. And he says, "Now if Timotheus come, see that he may be with you without fear, for he worketh the work of the Lord, as I also do." I want you to look at the second chapter of 2 Corinthians, and this is important, I think. Verse 13, he says, "I had no rest in my spirit because I found not Timothy my brother. I found not Titus, my brother." Now, I assume that either they refused to accept Timothy, or Timothy, who was delicate, was not able to go. There was some reason why Timothy did not go to Corinth. It has not pleased the Lord to reveal that to us. And so, Paul sent the next best man. He sent Titus. As he says here, "I found not Titus my brother." Look at chapter 7 just for a moment. He says in verse 6, "Nevertheless God," isn't that a grand statement? "Nevertheless God." There are men, you know, who did not believe in God. And the talk on the tremendous exactness and immensity of creation has so affected them, they have become convinced of the presence and the wisdom and power of God, so that we could say, "Nevertheless, God." Well, that's the language Paul uses. "Nevertheless, God, that comforteth those that are cast down, comforted us by the coming of Titus, and not by his coming only, but by the consolation wherewith he was comforted in you when he told us your earnest desire," and so and so. Titus eventually came from Corinth. But you see, Paul's original appointments miscarried. He was disappointed. He wanted Timothy to go. He didn't go. Then he wanted Titus to go, and Titus was delayed in his return. The exact arrangement that Paul made just simply miscarried. you ever make arrangements then, Miss Carrie? Did you ever draw up your little schedule and then somehow or another it seems to collapse? What you intended to do and what you wanted others to do with you or for you, and the whole thing just collapses. And you are left completely disappointed. Oh, I am sure you've had the same experience as I. In the morning, instinctively, you have made your little schedule for the day. 9 a.m., so-and-so. 10 a.m., so-and-so. 1 p.m., so-and-so. 3 o'clock, such-and-such. 5 o'clock, something more. And when you go to bed at 10 o'clock and you review the day, you wonder what in all the world happened to your little schedule. It just didn't work out. I sometimes say to my daughter, Jane, well, I've been busy all day, but I accomplished nothing. Maybe you've never had times like that. Maybe you always accomplish. Well, I admit I don't. I make plans, you know. I have agendas, too. And many, many a time when it comes to bed and I'm getting down before the Lord, well, what have I done today? What have I really accomplished in view of eternity? And you know, I'm quite disappointed with myself. And believe it or not, sometimes with other people too. Plans, Miss Carrie. Let me call your attention to something more. Maybe this would fit into your life better than the idea of miscarried plans. In going over these scriptures that we have in 1 Corinthians, notice what Paul has to say again in that passage we read from chapter 2. He says, furthermore, when I came to Troas to preach Christ's gospel, and a door was opened unto me of the Lord, I had no rest in spirit. But taking my leave of them, I went from thence into Macedonia. Can you imagine the Apostle Paul becoming so utterly discouraged that he turned his back upon an open door of service? That's almost incredible, unless we believe that he was a man of like passion as we are. But here he is, and he is so utterly discouraged. God takes him right to Troas again. You know, I had been there before. God takes him right to Troas, and the door is wide open. He had attempted to preach there before, and God forbade that he teach there. But now there's the door wide open. Just go in, Paul. Possessed for Christ. Everything's wrong. Everything's black. I don't understand it. And he turns his back on an open door. What discouragement can do? Look again at this passage in chapter 7. Passage we read. For when we were come into Macedonia, and I assume that this is Philippi, our flesh had no rest, for we were troubled on every side, with outward fightings, within were fears. He had come to Troas, and the Lord said, Paul, the door's wide open. Go in and possess. I'm too discouraged. Things are too dark. Things are just not according to Hoyle. I just can't go. And he leaves Troas, but eventually he crosses from Asia Minor into Macedonia, and I repeat, I think he makes his way down to Philippi. And is he any better off in Philippi? Think of this. With outward fighting, with inward fears, what a conflict. Inward conflict. Real struggles going on inside. Paul's discouraged. I can't imagine anyone being lower down than Paul at this time. He speaks of being cast down. You never get there. You ever get there? Cast down. But let me read this passage to you again. For when we were come into Macedonia, our flesh had no rest, for we were troubled on every side with outward fightings, with inward fears. Nevertheless, God that comforteth those that are cast down comforted us. He comforted us by the coming at Titus. Nevertheless, God comforted us. You were pretty blue that time, Paul. You were pretty far down, weren't you? Yes. Nevertheless, God comforted us. And going over the reading of this morning, I see that this gave rise to Paul's ministry of the heart. He makes other statements in the first chapter to the Corinthians. He says that God brought this all about in order that, first of all, he might learn not to trust in himself. And what a lesson. Just what a lesson. Here's the great apostle to the Gentiles, a tremendous worker, a man very, very, very capable. You know, in our country, we hear a great deal about bilingualism. Well, Paul wasn't bilingual. I don't know what he was. I know he was at least trilingual and probably more. A very, very capable gentleman. But God had to teach him not to trust in himself. Not to trust in what he had been taught by others. That's the first thing. He wasn't to trust in himself. The second thing God taught him was that he was to trust in God, who not only lives, but who imparts life. If I cannot trust myself, God knows I can't. I can trust him. The living, the eternal, omnipotent God, I can trust him. And he has taught us through the circumstances of life to do that. And I think there is one other thing that he learned through all these sufferings that seemed to besiege him from time to time. He learned to appreciate the prayers of God's beloved people. Ye also helping together by prayer for us. In myself, nothing. I cannot trust myself. God is everything, and I may rely completely on him. But I cannot ignore the sympathy, the understanding, the prayers of God's beloved people. And out of all this springs Paul's wonderful ministry of the heart. It was that way with the book of Psalms. This is something true, not only of Paul, but of the psalmist. The Lord is my shield and buckler. How do you know
the valley of Elah, when I encountered Goliath of Gath, there was a shield that protected me. The Lord is my strong tower. How do you know, David? Just how do you know? Well, that was a wonderful lookout, that high tower. I was able to follow the pursuing groups of Saul's soldiers and to avoid them. The Lord is my strength. How do you know? Well, did you ever hear of Absalom? Did you ever hear that when I was an old man, I had to leave my palace home and my throne, and that only God himself could sustain me? You see, out of all the troubles of the psalmist, we have that wonderful book of experience, the Psalms. And so out of Paul's personal problems and difficulties, we have his heart ministry, and I trust that the Spirit of God will lead us as we seek to investigate and interpret the heart ministry of Paul.